Okay, guys, our custom will be to do the review. So you had some review questions. So we'll try to do the review questions here this morning. Also, be aware that we will always go back sometimes and review questions that we've covered in previous classes. So hopefully, if you missed some questions in the past or didn't have time to do them, try to make an effort to go back and do them. Okay, so we started last class talking about our lesson is shaking hands with the prophets. And our whole point here is to get to know the prophets, who they are, their backgrounds, family, what their names mean, what are some of the characteristics, what are the occupations. And we said the reason why we do that is because we're reading their writings. And you can see in many cases, their backgrounds are reflected in their writings. So great appreciation of these men will help us to better understand, have greater appreciation for their writings. So question number 10 is, what does each of the prophet name mean? I won't ask anyone to go through the list there. Hopefully you've done the list. And we went through these things on the last class period. Hosea means salvation or deliver. And again, I made that point. Here is a man. God's appointing this man. The last prophet before this northern kingdom is taken into captivity. The prophet before him, Amos, prophesied to the same nation, was saying, you know, the time has come. Your nation's going to be taken in exile. Then you have Hosea. He said, well, what's going on here? Here's the deliverer. Here's the Savior. Sent by God. That's what his name means. And we went down to class. We pointed out that if you go to Hosea in chapter 14, it talks about returning to me. There's still the hope of salvation. Yes, he was a deliverer. Yes, he was salvation. And what were the people to do? They were to repent. Did God know that they would not repent as a whole as a nation? He knew that. Yet he's still sending these prophets, still concerned about them. And so, interesting, his name. Joel means Jehovah is God. Amos, a burden bearer. Amos was the other prophet to the north we just mentioned. His name is burden bearer. What burden does he bury? The northern kingdom is going to exile. Interesting how these names of some of these prophets kind of tie into their work. Is that by coincidence? Is that by God's plan? A lot of that we don't have revelation to know precisely that's how he did it. And if he did, how did God work through the parents and name them? Kind of interesting to think about. But whatever it is, you know, these names do have interesting names to them. Obadiah, servant of Jehovah. Jonah, dove. Here's Jonah. Going to their arch enemies, Nineveh, ruthless enemies. And here his name means dove. Would you send a dove to your enemies and tell them that to their enemies and say, your kingdom is up. Judgment is going to be to the nation. Unfortunately, they repented. But interesting. Micah, who is like God. Nahum, comforter or consoler. Jonah and Nahum go together, prophesy to the same nation, Nineveh. And in the case of Nahum, there was judgment going to be done on the northern kingdom. And so why is he called comforter? Well, I don't exactly know why, but definitely be a comforter to the people in Judah because their enemy is going to be finally brought into judgment. Habakkuk, embrace. Zephaniah, Jehovah has treasure or Jehovah has hidden. And then Haggai, festive. Zechariah, Jehovah remembers. And the last one, Malachi, my messenger. Okay, next question. It'd be good to teach you to get the question right. It's really not a right answer. Number 11, I left out a great four generations here for this particular prophet. It goes all the way back to King Hezekiah. So which prophet was the great, great grandson of King Hezekiah? Ken? Zephaniah. Good. And so we looked at backgrounds, family backgrounds. Many of the prophets we don't know much about, but some are pretty extensive. And here we have this particular prophet have royalty in him, right? Go all the way back to King Hezekiah. Okay, now another interesting prophet. Which prophet was from a priestly family? John, I think. Zechariah. And we see that as his... we learned about that because his grandfather was Iddo. Iddo was one of the priests that specifically named as far as one of the priests that would return from Babylon captivity. And so he was from the priestly family. Which prophet was likely a citizen of the northern kingdom? Javier? Okay, Hosea. Pronunciations, I'll be pronouncing Hosea. Other pronunciation, Hosea, like Javier. So we won't. Any pronunciation that would be fine. Either one, or if you have a different one, not going to really get into the pronunciation. We talked about that. Okay, which prophet was from the southern kingdom but prophesied to the northern kingdom? Matt?
Amos.
Okay, Amos. And we'll talk a little bit more about him. A very interesting prophet. And we'll take, here's some past review questions. What are the two types of prophets? Anyone on this one? What are the two major groups? Okay, minor and major. Very good, Susan. And the other one?
Oral
literary. You say, why is that important for us to know that in a Bible class? Well, because if you're reading books, commentaries, or you hear people say, talk about the major prophets, minor, you say, well, you understand. You can understand what they're talking about. We understand why they're called minor. Hopefully, we're not in the mindset that because they're minor prophets, we don't read them, we don't study them. And that's very important why they were called minor. And that gets to the next question, why are they called minor? And hopefully, by now, it's obvious, and you renew that it's the length of the literary work. Other words used for prophets, one term that used equivalent we find pretty prominent is prophet and seer. But there are other terms used, man of God, servant of God, messenger of God, not uniquely for a prophet, but prophets are called that also. Okay, so we left off on, I think it was page 12. We were talking about location. Where are these different prophets from? And we've talked about, I think we finished Amos was the last one we finished, and we already talked about Obadiah. So now we'll turn and look at Jonah. Now, just like we mentioned, one of the keys to studying the prophets is using harmony. And so we use not only the specific writings to try to find this information out, but we use other scriptures. In the particular case of Jonah, interesting, in the book of Jonah, his location is not really given. But you go to 2 Kings 14:25, we won't turn there. It actually tells us where he's from. In the city there, as you can see on the map, you have in your notebooks, is a city called Gath-Hepher, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. You get that from 2 Kings 14:25. And also, when we get into our next lesson, you also see not only you get his location from 2 Kings 14:25, but you'll get a time indicator that will help us to time the book of Jonah. So that's where he's from, and you can kind of see where that's at map right there on the close to the Sea of Galilee. If you do some searches or research on the city Gath-Hepher, it was one of the cities when Joshua was dividing up the land. It was one of the cities on the boundaries for the tribe of Zebulun. You can go look at it in Joshua 19:13. So it was one of the cities to mark the boundaries of the Zebulun tribe territory. Some other maps here that are related to Jonah. Of course, we know about Jonah. He went to Nineveh to go ahead and proclaim the message of judgment upon Nineveh. So many times in the Bibles, names are given, but something else is intended. Nineveh was the capital of Assyria, the great kingdom of Assyria. And so Nineveh was its capital. So when he talks about judgment on Nineveh, he's really talking about the Assyrian Empire. And the Assyrian Empire actually extended its boundaries, even was larger than the boundaries of Babylon. Sometimes we don't recognize that, but that was the case. And Nineveh, you remember the geography here. Here we have the Palestine, Jerusalem, and so forth. We have the desert. And so this is known as the Fertile Crescent. And why is the Fertile Crescent? Because of the rivers, and you got a desert here. So when people traveled from east to west, they traveled in the Fertile Crescent. And so Nineveh located its capital, Assyria, in Nineveh. Now, we're going to see in Nahum a judgment on Nineveh or Assyria. In Nahum, we're going to see that it was mentioned, actually see in Jonah and Nahum. This was a very great, great city. We'll see in Jonah, it talked about him walking across the city, and it took him 3 days just to walk. They actually called it a great city. So it's a world, ancient world capital at that time of Assyria. And when Nahum prophesied that there would be judgment on Nineveh and Assyria, Babylon went ahead and destroyed Nineveh. It was a great, great city. And after they destroyed it, they destroyed everything. There is no city of Nineveh now. Great, great city. There are no ancient ruins there. The city is located, you can see the Tigris River. It's on the east side of the Tigris River. And right across of it is Mosul. We're very familiar with Iraq and Mosul. The city is Mosul. It's on the east side of the Tigris River. And so in Nahum, it talks about that the city is going to be a desolate, like a wilderness. That's what it is. The archaeologists have gone and dug and have found some of the ancient ruins. And they're starting to rebuild some of the city in the last decade or so. But again, it was completely destroyed. And again, God's judgment on a nation. And that was one of our points. Okay, now, being familiar with another map that's kind of connected to Jonah, because remember the story of Jonah, right? God told him to go. He refused. He went down to Joppa, took a boat. And where did he go? He went to Tarshish. What's Tarshish? It's kind of Spain. That's 2,500 miles away, and he had to go to Nineveh 550 miles or so. You see here, he's going great distances to avoid God's instructions to him and trying to get away from Nineveh. So, kind of another map related to Jonah. Okay, let's go on to Micah. Micah 1:1, we find where Micah was from. The city was called Moresheth. And you can see that's located in Judah. You can see here's Jerusalem, and here is Moresheth. And this is Moresheth Gath. And on the map here, Gath was a Philistine city. And sometimes you'll see those two combined, so they were kind of next to each other. So very, very close to Philistine, the enemies of Israel. Okay, so now we move to Nahum. And I asked you the question here. We're provided where Nahum was from. He was a Ekoshite. And I asked you a question, where was this particular place located at? What did you find in your search?
Not for sure.
Right. Bottom line answer is, do not know. Unknown. Scholars have said, I've listed four possible locations, and all these locations are completely all over the map. One of the areas, interesting, has him located really close to Nineveh, 24 miles north of Mosul. We said Mosul is right next to Nineveh. And actually, today they have a tomb there that the Christians, in quotation marks, and Mohammedans point out that that's his tomb, Nahum. You say, well, how would he be way over there? Well, it's speculated here, and again, this we don't know for sure, that when the northern kingdom was taken into captivity, a lot of the residents were taken to that particular area, and he was taken there and born right around that area. Again, really do not know. The second place they have is south of Babylon. You know where Babylon is? Way down further south. Some have in the northern Galilee. A fourth one has near Jerusalem. So point is, don't know. All over the map. So, you say, well, why did God provide that information to us? Well, again, we mentioned we're reading letters were not written to us. These letters were written to people and nations. And possibly at that time they knew exactly who it is, where he was from. But the scholars and the history, we don't know. The rest of these prophets will skip very, very quickly. The rest of them, as we follow in the order, we find them in our Bible. Basically, location unknown. Okay, now let's get to occupations. A lot of these say, well, the occupation with the prophet, yes, but we find that they also had some other occupations. The first one, of course, is Hosea. We know he's a prophet. Joel was a prophet. Don't have no other information about that. But one we do have additional information is Amos. So let's open our Bibles to Amos 1:1. Amos 1:1, and let's note a few of these. It says, the words of Amos, who was among the sheep herders from Tekoa. We talked about his location. So he was among the sheep herders, indicating that he was a herdsman. And then go to Amos 7:14. Amos 7:14. Remember I mentioned to you, remember Amos was a prophet to the southern kingdom. He's prophesying to the northern kingdom. The king of the northern kingdom is giving him some opposition, and this is the Amaziah. Then and Amos is answering back to him, and Amos answered and said to Amaziah, "Am I not a prophet? Nor I am the son of a prophet, for I am a herdsman and a grower of sycamore figs." So not only was Amos a prophet sent by God, he was also a herdsman. We talked about the sheep that he herded, a special type of sheep in the rugged country where he was located. But he was also a grower of sycamore figs. Hopefully when you hear about sycamore, it reminds you of Zacchaeus. Remember Zacchaeus? He climbed a tree. It was a sycamore tree. I didn't bring a picture of a sycamore tree, but a very prominent tree in the Middle East. And it does, under circumstances, grow figs. Here's a picture of the sycamore figs. It's like a fig, like a date, a little bit sweeter, a little bit more aromatic than a normal fig. But, you know, that's what his occupation was. So Amos had his hands busy. He said, why is this all important here? Well, note a few things here in Amos. Go to Amos chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. So Amos was a man who's outside, right? If you took care of the sheep, you don't go to your house at night. You stay outside. And this was a rugged country where Amos was from. And you'll see a lot of things talking about the wildlife. Amos chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. It says, "Do two men walk together unless they have made an appointment? Does a lion roar in a forest when he has no prey? Does a young lion growl from the den unless he has captured something?" And then talks about the birds. So you see here talking a lot about nature and animals. In verse 12, "Thus says the Lord, just as a shepherd snatches from the lion's mouth a couple of legs or a piece of an ear, so will the sons of Israel dwell in Samaria be snatched away." And it goes on. So you see, again, his writings is reflected, his background is being reflected in his writings. Go to chapter 5, verse 8. So what does a herdsman have to stay outside all night? What does he do when the sheep are laying and going to sleep and he's getting ready to go to sleep? You look at the stars. Know what he says in 5, 8. He says, "He who made Pleiades and Orion." What is those? Those are star constellations. And you find those mentioned in his writings. Well, why is he doing that? Well, he spent a lot of time looking at the sky, and sometimes we think that people during that age were ignorant. They didn't know about the constellations, but you know that goes way back to the Egyptians when they studied the stars and started mapping and seeing patterns and started giving them names. And how Amos knew that they were there, whether it be by inspiration or by knowledge, secular knowledge at the time, don't know. But the point is, you see that in his writings about that. Okay, so that's Amos. Obadiah, nothing more said about Obadiah in terms of occupation. And then the rest of them will jump all the way down to Zechariah. So the other ones, we have no other information other than they were prophets. And again, remember, there's only three prophets where the word prophet is mentioned in their writings, but you have an equivalent phrase all through. It says, "The word of the Lord came to the prophet." The word of the Lord came. Very prominent. It actually occurs 8 times in the minor prophets. Okay. And we talked already about Zechariah. Now, Zechariah, we know not only was he a prophet, it was one of the review questions, but he was also a priest. And we get that from what we already talked about. Interesting to note, as you think about that, the combination here, prophet and priest. Probably don't remember this. I didn't remember it. But Jeremiah and Ezekiel were also prophet and priest. And so here's another man in the minor prophets who had a dual role. And so he had other things to do. Okay, then we had Malachi. Nothing said about Malachi. All right, so now let's look at some of the characteristics. This section, last section here, is just to note some other things about these men. We try to gather from secular and from what's said in their writings in terms of specific things, but we note some other things in their writings about these men. And the first one we'll look at, of course, is Hosea. Follow them in the same order we find them in the canon. We have here on the slide, and you see in your notes, that Hosea was a prophet of sympathy, love, and compassion. If you hold your finger there and turn to your text, where we have the text, hopefully you still have your text with you, put it in your notebook. What I did in the text is mark words. And one thing you will note in Hosea is the word love, loves, love occurs over and over throughout this book, 19 times. And go with me to Hosea chapter 3 and verse 1. Here we see a section here where Hosea is commanded to go and buy his wife back. And note, just in verse 3, 1, we have actually three occurrences of the word love. And so it says here, then the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband. Okay? And so he loved his husband. It says, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord, and we'll get into this story about Gomer and Hosea, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. Significant the raisin cakes, an idolatry practice of involved in their worship. So the way, going back to our notes here, Hosea is really a prophet. We call him the prophet of love, because you find in his letter a lot of sympathy, a lot of love, a lot of compassion. And so this is a man that God is using. He was a man that you might say is full of emotion and love and stern and compassion. We could sum up Hosea's spirit in one word, and that word, one word would be loving kindness. And that was a man, interesting, sent to a nation that was getting ready to be taken away and be destroyed. But God is using this man. And so this is one of his traits, one of his characteristics. Joel, I don't have much to say about that other than we are very familiar that his prophecy is in Acts chapter 2. And so, you know, one of his characteristics, he has been known as the prophet of the Pentecost. Why is that? Because of his prophecy, the prominent prophecy that we find in Acts chapter 2. Hey, what about Amos? Now, we've been alluding to him quite often here, and hopefully you've gotten a good picture of Amos. Again, both Amos and Hosea were prophets to the north. The kingdom that was going to be taken into, to be destroyed and be taken away. The way we can look at Amos is his characteristics can be summed up in one word, and that is justice. And also you'll see from him that he must have been evidently a very strong-willed man, right? So here he is, a man from the southern kingdom, a farmer, a herdsman, going to the northern kingdom to prophesy to the people. You know, it would take a pretty strong-willed, tough, thick-skinned type of person. And evidently Amos was that type of person. We see he was a very rugged person, being from where he was, outdoors, and the occupation that he had. You'll find in his writings, he's a really stern prophet, one of justice and righteousness. And his message, of course, the Northern Kingdom is the curtain call. Your nation is up, going to be taken exile, kind of, that's it. He reminds me a lot of Amos. I think I've talked about this some time ago, about John the Baptist. Outdoorsman, we know how John the Baptist was, eating honey and locusts, what he wore. Amos, and the way he spoke, how he John the Baptist confronted the opposition, the Pharisees and scribes, and the way he was. You know, I would say that Amos is cut from the same type of cloth as John the Baptist. So Amos was a prophet of justice. We go now to Obadiah. We know Obadiah was a prophet, where he's going to pronounce a judgment on Edom. Go with me to Obadiah here. And we have here the censure of ridicule. You might have been a little bit unclear what was intended by that. But if you go to Obadiah, of course you know it's the shortest book, only one chapter, and look at verse 12. Here, Obadiah is a judgment on Edom. We're very familiar with Edom, and we'll talk a lot more about Edom. But look at verse 12. This is a reason given why God is going to bring judgment on Edom, and Obadiah provides it. He says in verse 12, do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their destruction. So what he's doing, he is censoring Edom. And so censor ridicule. Don't be ridiculing your blood brothers. And of course, we know how the story of Edom goes way back to Jacob and Esau. We're back to that point in time. Okay, what about Jonah? Now, Jonah, how do we describe Jonah? We know Jonah by what he did, that he was definitely a proud man, a very self-centered and egotist, willful, fretful. And so when you think about that, how would you describe that? Well, I guess one word you might say is Jonah was a very foolish man, right? Running away from God, thinking he could avoid God, not listening to what he was instructed to do. A foolish man. Can you imagine that? God using a foolish man to proclaim his word? Well, that's what he is. Fortunately, though, Jonah had the humility and the disposition to change his course back to God's will. And even after that, you see a little bit tense. You remember in chapter 4, where the tree grows up, God provides the tree, and then it withers, and he starts complaining. This tree withered, you know, in chapter 4, kind of end of the narrative there. And so he was a very finical, very foolish man. Evidently, he had a good heart, and he would change. And sometimes God uses men like that. Think about the Apostle Peter, right? We talk about foolish men. Men that put their foot in their mouths. Peter, you might describe as one. We know what Peter said, that he would never deny the Lord, denied him three times. He told the Lord that he would die for him. He said that very blatantly, emphatic, foolish statement. And, of course, he wouldn't even have a cross. They fled in the Garden of Gethsemane. And so God does use foolish men. The key, though, is he was evidently penitent. He changed, and he did that. But God is using Jonah, a foolish man. Interesting how God uses people, and he doesn't change. Even though there are not prophets like today, he uses all types of people, all abilities, and through his providence, works with people, and. Sometimes when we look at our own lives, have we ever been foolish in our own lives and made mistakes and done things that were wrong? And fortunately, through our good hearts and God's will and his messages, we've kind of turned it around and got back on the right track. We all have, you might say it sometimes, have been foolish. Well, Jonah was a man like that. Okay, let's go to the next man, Nahum, and note something here about Nahum. Now, of all the minor prophets, we might say, well, you got the minor prophets. Who's the minor of the minors? Well, it may be Nahum. Again, a judgment to the Nineveh. And you might quickly read that and say, well, I'm not going to pay too much attention to Nahum. Scholars who have analyzed the Bible, very familiar with language and poetry, say that Nahum's writings are one of the most poetic writings in the Bible. It's comparable to some of the writings of David in Psalms. And so note that even though it's not identified specifically in that he was a poet, you can tell by looking at his writings, scholars in his writing. Let's go to Nahum chapter 1 and just read this thing. And so when you go back and reread these books, think about that. We might have read it very quickly here, but very, very poetic. We'll start in verse 2. And note, of course, it's set up in poetry style, arithmetic, the short lines. Some of them are parallel. It's a jealous and avenging God is the Lord. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries and exerts wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. The Lord will by no means leave the guilty unpunished. In whirlwind and storm is his way, and clouds are the dust beneath his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. The blossoms of Lebanon wither. Mountains quake because of him, and the hills dissolve. Indeed, the Lord is upheaved by his presence, the world and all the inhabitants in it. So, as you kind of stop by and read it slowly and see what's saying, you see the very, very poetic, a very abbreviated, very powerful message, very picturesque things that he's using. And so, a poet. And so we looked at occupations. And so we could probably say Nahum evidently was either a poet or had the ability to write very poetic means. We know every word is inspired, every tense is correct, but evidently God is using this ability of Nahum to be able to write very beautifully and in a poetic manner. Okay, let's move on now to the next prophet, Habakkuk. And let's look at something about Habakkuk. And the thing we want to note here is, go back to chapter 3 in verse 19. We find similar things in the Psalms, where there is either superscription or other notes here. And we have a particular note that we find at chapter 3, verse 19. And at the very end, and we know that in Habakkuk, we know that the last chapter is a prayer psalm, a very beautiful prayer written in a psalm form. And at the very end, what do we find here? It says, "For the choir director on my string instruments." So what is all that about? Well, we know that the Levites, or we know that in the Levites, they were in charge of the music and the instruments to be played to be worshiping God. They had specific duties. And actually, you go back to Exodus, you'll find that God gave some of the Levites who were in charge of that special abilities to play very, very beautiful music. And so as Habakkuk finishes it, he says, "This is what is this for? It is for the choir director on my stringed instruments." So this indicates to us or that he was possibly of the tribe of Levi, one of the priests or in charge of either the temple singers or was involved in that. You see, his particular writings are to be used in the worship service, in the musical part of the worship service. So another way to look at Habakkuk is because of this note and chapter 3 that he was a musician. So interesting how you can start picking some of these things out of these writings here. And so, again, we kind of step back and say, well, boy, we got royalty. We got a priest. We got a farmer. We got a grower of sycamore figs. We have a poet. We got a musician. All these different occupations we're picking up. So gives a better appreciation for these men. And again, God is evidently using their abilities. He had the ability, evidently, and, you know, this is for part of the worship service. Okay, let's move on now to the next prophet, Zephaniah. I have a lot to say about Zephaniah other than books that I looked at and things I studied. He's known as Zephaniah the orator. The next man we're going to look at is Haggai. Now, let's turn there. Actually, we want to look at some other verses. Now, he, as we know, is known as the prophet of the temple rebuilding. We know in the situation of Haggai, he was the first prophet that returned from Babylon back to Jerusalem in 536. And so he was a prophet here. And we know his mission, of course, was to get the people to finish rebuilding the temple. We want to note some things, though, in Haggai. Go to chapter 2 and verse 3. Haggai chapter 2, verse 3. Now, some of the things, you cannot be so dogmatic about this. There might be some possible different interpretations. But in chapter 2, verse 3 here, as he's encouraging the people, you know, they build the temple. He says, "Who is left among you who saw the temple in its former glory?" Without referring back to Solomon's temple. "And how do you see it now? Does it not seem to you like nothing in comparison?" Again, the issue here was the temple was not as great as the temple of Solomon. Yeah, they rebuilt it, but it wasn't in the glory. And this may indicate that Haggai was present when the first Solomon's temple, that temple was destroyed in 586. And, of course, they returned in 536. So that's 50 years between the old temple, Solomon's temple being existing, and the time of this writing. And if you place upon him another 20 or 30 years, Haggai might be an older man. He might be 70 to 80 years of age, assuming that he was present. You know, did he actually see it, or is he just making a reference? There's two possibilities, but some think that it could have been that he was actually there. And that, what the point of all that is, it indicates that he was an elderly man, an elderly
prophet.
When we go to, you don't need to turn there. You might want to write these scriptures down, Ezra 5:1 and Ezra 6:14. We know that when the prophets, when the captives came back from Babylon to Judea and Jerusalem, two prophets came, Haggai and Zechariah. And in Ezra 5:1 and 6:14, they're both mentioned about and their work. It actually tells us that they were very successful in their work, and credit is given to them by Ezra in his book. But the thing to note here is how they are listed. And you will always find Haggai before Zechariah. And the significance of that, possible significance of that, is you always put the elderly first in a list. And remember, who was Zechariah? He was a priest. We're going to see also that he was head of a household. Zechariah was a very influential man. He's not listed first, but he's listed second. So that, along with what we looked at there in chapter 2, verse 3, indicates that he was an elderly man. But the key thing about the Haggai was, and his main mission and sole mission was to rebuild the temple. So he's known as the prophet of the temple, temple building. Okay, now Zechariah, we already talked about Zechariah, about him being a priest, and I just mentioned about another thing about Zechariah. Evidently, his influence was very great. Not only was he a prophet, not only was he a priest, but he was also head of the father's house. We get that from Zechariah 2:4, where lists are provided, and heads of houses are listed, and he's in that group. And so, put here that was some of his characteristics. And so, the last man that we have is Malachi, and we'll see that he was a lecturer. We'll get more into the writings and the style of writings, but these are just some things to note about some other characteristics. Okay, so as we kind of looked at it, basically completes our lesson on the shaking hands with the prophets. So hopefully we have a better appreciation for these men. And what I would encourage you to do, if you have some time, as you go back, try doing some rereading of the books and read it with some of these things in mind that we talked about. And as it will probably be your case, as it was in my case, you'll start seeing other things about their writings. The writings will come, will mean more to you. You'll start getting more out of them because of having this background information. We made the point, I think, in terms of our lessons here. I made a lesson, made a point of this in our last class. We'll look at this next lesson here. But again, as we look at all these things, and I think we made this point last time, but think about how God has used all types of people with different abilities and their background to accomplish His purposes. And the lesson for us here is that, you know, God uses us. We don't have to be an elder or a preacher. You know, He uses all in His kingdom to accomplish His purposes. We all have different abilities, different occupations, and we need to utilize them. And I would like for us to think about, sometimes we look at these prophets and we may be gender-oriented. Well, all the minor prophets are all male. And what about the females? Well, females have their abilities for the family, and they have their abilities to serve. And God uses us women. You know the very familiar phrase that we've heard so much and so true. The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the nation. And women have a big role in the families and the work in the kingdom and developing the families. I would say it's been my observation and my experience that in a household, women can have a stronger influence than the fathers and the husbands. And so do not discount, if you're a female, do not discount your role in bringing up your family and teaching them the Word of God and providing a foundation for them and bringing them up. And so, you know, point is that God uses all people, male and female, with their different abilities. This last lesson I have on the overhead is, it may bother someone that there is so much personal information we don't know about these prophets. Some places, like Nahum, we don't even know where he's at, but yet we're provided information. That should not present a problem to us, because these are not biographies, these books that we're reading. They're not biographies about these men. We're reading this information, and Holy Spirit provided. We talked about that, why we are studying the minor prophets, for those reasons. These prophets had a mission. They were God's spokesmen to bring the message to the people. And a lot of information we don't know about, but it's not important, because God is using these men to bring His word, to turn the people around, to turn the people back to them. But it's interesting, though, even though we may not know a lot about them, they are recorded. We do have these men in this book, and we've had it for hundreds of thousands of years. And so God has recorded them for the purpose. They accomplished the mission that they were sent on in terms of doing their work. And so as we wrap up this part of our lesson, hopefully this has been beneficial. And the main merit is it kind of sets a foundation for our other studies, and hopefully sets a foundation for us in one of the foundations in understanding their writings and having a great appreciation for their work. Okay, so that's all the material that I want to have for this morning. Let me introduce the class for the next two class periods. So now we're going to move on Wednesday to lesson number 3. Let's just kind of go through and see the different parts of it. This lesson here is titled The Audience in the Times of the Writing. So the previous lesson was to look at the prophets. Look at them. It's an inward look to the prophets. Now this lesson is an outward look, where the prophet is looking out to the people. And so the first part I've asked you to do is when any type of historical study, you want to know, when did they write? And so in your notes, you'll see here two time charts. And there are two of them because a lot of information on them. I had to break them up into two pieces. What I'm asking you to do here is, wherever you see a red box, fill in what prophet goes in that box. You say, well, how do I do that? Very easily. All you do is you read those verses under A2. Those verses will give you some key piece of information to help you to place where these prophets are. And when you look at these timelines, look at the kings. Who was the other kings other than Israel or Judah? And then you look, you've got other prophets there. And so that's kind of the first thing. So we'll help time put this in reference in terms of time. The next part is contemporary prophets. And contemporary prophets, I'm looking at prophets that were in the same general time period. Some are more contemporary than others in terms of they were either referred to one another, or they may be directed to the same group of people. But I'm looking at grouping them together in terms of time-wise. And so there's a little table with red boxes. And so the red box indicates that there are other prophets that you need to kind of fill that in. So that's Roman numeral 3, the contemporary prophets. Roman numeral 4 is the audience. So we're looking at the time period and who were the other prophets. Now, who was the primary audience and the secondary audience? And, you could actually put a third, we could be an audience. But we're looking at the primary, we're primarily written to. And in the writing, sometimes there's a secondary audience, and that will be identified. And all you do is read those scriptures there, and hopefully there's enough information there to be able to say who was the audience. And then the last section there is the times of the writing. And this is trying to understand what was the condition of the people, morally, spiritually, religiously, politically, during the time of the writing. And the way we're going to accomplish this here is, and you'll see here, is I pulled out from the text of the minor prophets things that the prophets say that indicate the condition of the people. I ask you to read the verse, and you can fill in the blanks. And when you fill about that and read these verses here, you'll see their condition. So that is the next part of the lesson. Okay, well, that's, I think...